Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday, the 12th of August. Very nice to have you with us and a delight to have a great group of panelists as always. And of course, we welcome you as well. I'll tell you how you can get in on this in just a moment. 9:13 on the 12th of August, and it's a warm day, but I think we'll maybe a little bit better than yesterday. I don't know, a little bit better, tiny bit better. That's it. You know, we'll take a degree or two, I guess. Very nice again to have you here. If you'd like to be a part of the program, all you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce our panel to you, and we will get started. Former New York 19th Congressman and New York Assemblyman John Faso joins us. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm well. Good to see you, sir.
Good to see you. Very nice and nice to have you back on the program.
Well, it's great to be here, and it's August, so it's a short month for me.
Yeah, a short month, but it's the dog days. You know, you just and it's going to go really quick before it's
a month to get away.
That's right. Well, we're glad you are here today. We're lucky. We won the lottery. We spun the wheel, and two symbols came up on the same row. We got Karen Riedel yesterday. We got Karen Riedel today, and we're very, very excited. Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College and president of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley. Good morning. Thanks for coming back.
Good morning. I'm glad to be back again. And if you need me tomorrow, I'll happily come back too.
Yes, and you have a good commute. So thank you very much for doing that. I really appreciate
that.
That's you schlep. So that's very nice. We're also thrilled to have the mayor of this city of Albany, New York, Kathy Sheehan, with us. Good morning, Mayor. How are you?
I am good. It's great to be here.
Excellent. Wonderful to have you on the program as always. Let's talk about another city who's dealing with, all kinds of things these days. As the president announced yesterday that they are going to have the federal government move on D.C., the District of Columbia. And they're looking to deploy the National Guard. And this was announced yesterday at a press conference while we were on the air. And we talked a bit about it, although we were talking mostly around what we knew as opposed to what was coming out at that particular time. So the president announced Monday that he was placing the D.C. police under direct federal control and will deploy the National Guard to the streets of Washington to fight crime, an extraordinary flex of federal power that strips city leadership of its ability to make law enforcement decisions and could expose residents of the nation's capital to unpredictable encounters with a domestically deployed military force. The decision to take over the D.C. police and deploy 800 National Guard troops comes as the president has been slamming America's cities as places where crime is out of control, despite 2 years of declines that have brought homicide levels in many major cities to their lowest levels in decades. So let's quickly talk about what that means for the city of Washington, D.C. During a 78-minute news conference during which he was flanked by several members of his cabinet, Mr. Trump took the lectern in the White House briefing room and said he intended to clear out the Capitol's homeless population without saying how officials would do it or detailing where those people would go. He said that he needed to fight crime in a city that he claimed was overrun with, quote, bloodthirsty criminals, even though crime numbers in Washington are falling. From January 1st through August 10th, the number of violent crimes is down from 4,000 to 1,500. And those are just some of the numbers that show deep declines in crime within our nation's capital. There are practical questions about how Mr. Trump's plans would be implemented. The Trump administration is relying on a provision of the D.C. Home Rule Act, a law passed by Congress in 1973, establishing local control of Washington. The law gives the president the power to temporarily take over the Metropolitan Police Department. A White House official says the takeover would last 30 days, a time limit outlined in the law. All right, Mayor, what would you think if the president of the United States said, okay, we're coming in and we're taking over?
I think that I would be very fearful for our residents, for the community writ large. This is a city that has a civilian police review board. It also has an organization called ACPAC that serves as an advisory board to the police department, because our residents want our city to be safe, but they also have a level of expectation about what community policing looks like and how we respond to a whole host of different challenges, that from quality of life issues to people who have addiction issues to homelessness to violent criminals. And they have an expectation that we have a police department that is able to handle that in ways that are acceptable here to community members. And when you think about what Mayor Bowser has done in a very difficult time in D.C. to drive crime down, to me, the question from other leaders should be, what are you doing? How is it working? And what additional resource could you use to either accelerate or continue that decline? We're always looking for resource and assistance at both the state level and the federal level, and support for strategies and tactics that are working, and data that demonstrates what tactics are working is really important. And so historically, that is a role that the federal government has played. They've looked at cities across the country. They look at what's working. In New York State, we have a gun violence reduction initiative that is funded in part by state resources, but it's incredibly data-driven, and it looks at very specific tactics and very specific interventions that have been demonstrated to drive down crime. And I think that had that been what the president was offering, that would have been something that would be welcomed by mayors across the country. This is very different. And so it's very important for people to understand FBI agents are not trained to do the type of law enforcement that happens in a city like Washington, D.C., or even in a city like Albany. We partner with the FBI all the time, particularly on investigations that might involve drug rings or gun smuggling or other initiatives that we do work with federal law enforcement on. But day-to-day patrols and responding to calls for an emotionally disturbed person, the types of calls that our police officers are trained on, whether it's de-escalation, whether it's knowing a community, whether it's understanding who within that community are your trusted communicators, that is not something that FBI agents, DEA agents, certainly not U.S. Marshals. We had an incident in the city of Albany where the U.S. Marshals chased an individual into a restaurant while the restaurant was open and took a person down in the kitchen of that restaurant. Our law enforcement would have chosen a different way of approaching that individual and would in all likelihood have not followed that individual into that restaurant, probably wouldn't have been in that situation in the first place, again, because those are things that we take into consideration. So that's my very long answer to say, you know, in this country, we have no patience for really looking at data, understanding what works, and having those community conversations. We are at a time when you have a president who can say things like bloodthirsty criminals, roving mobs, I'm just going to take care of this. And then he can tell his new head of the U.S. Marshals, if you're soft, weak, and pathetic like so many people, I will fire you so fast. So this is a president who is saying, let's beat him up, round him up, and put him on a bus to God knows where, And we know that that ultimately doesn't work in our communities.
So there's many things about this that concern me. One, so let me just go through them real quick and see what you think about this. One is this connection with the homeless, where that the connection being that because there is a large homeless population on the street, that is connected to what he sees as a high crime rate, which there's no evidence that crime rate has increased. There's also no evidence that particular population has anything to do with that. Where they're going to put them, no plan, what's going to happen to them. We're just going to clear the streets. I find that very troubling.
Well, I think that all of us are frustrated with the level of homelessness. Any level of homelessness in a community is frustrating. And unfortunately, because services are concentrated in cities, we bear the brunt of folks who are coming here from all over, not just from our cities, and experiencing homelessness. And so we are implementing a number of strategies to address this issue. And we have seen progress. And we're looking at what's working and what's And if it doesn't work, then we're going to have to pivot and do something differently. But I think that this idea of I'm just going to come in, and when you start talking about rounding up homeless people and moving them somewhere, you are now talking about people's constitutional rights. And for anyone to think that you can violate the constitutional rights of a homeless person, and because I don't like to see homeless people, maybe that's okay, you're already on a very, very, very dangerous road.
You're also just moving the problem to wherever, whether it be Virginia, Maryland, wherever.
And you need resource. I mean, are they going to be moved to, are you going to open up army bases and, that were closed and housed people there? Are you going to provide them services? What is it that you exactly plan to do? And so, again, I think this is a country of abundance. This is a country that has incredible talent, resource, economic power. We can address these issues and challenges, but we have a federal government that is cutting the very resources that cities and counties and communities relied on, like Medicaid, helping somebody who's homeless and has addiction issues access Medicaid so that they can get the health care that they need. So we're talking about cutting all of these things that really address the challenges that we're seeing and the quality of life issues in particular that we see. We're going to cut all of the resources for that. And the approach that this president is suggesting is a very frightening one, I think.
John Fasso.
Well, I think that the question in my mind is, I understand the law says that the federal government can take this action for a period of 30 days.
Right.
And after that, it'll depend upon whether they have congressional authorization to continue in and what fashion that will be and what length of time, we don't know. So I think the real question right now is how will the federal government intercede in terms of taking the control of the D.C. Police Department, and what actually will that mean? Using the National Guard, I understand they're not going to be used for civil law enforcement purposes, similar to what Governor Hochul did using the National Guard in the New York City subways. So we'll see how they implement it. But I think it's also very clear, and I've heard the reports and the one you read, Joe, the media is saying, well, the crime rate has gone down. Well, I looked this up this morning, actually, thinking about this issue coming here. And in the last year, I think 23 or 24 that the data are available, it said there were about 244, slightly less than 250 murders in D.C. D.C. is a city of under 700,000 people. If you compare that to New York City, where in the last reportable year was 2023, there were about 350 murders, which is markedly down from where it was in the pre-Giuliani era of New York, pre-Giuliani Bloomberg era in New York City. But the rate in D.C., where is six or seven times the murder rate that it is in New York City. So if you're looking at a comparable number, if New York City had the same type of murder rate, you'd be looking at over 2,000 people being murdered in New York City. And so there is a real problem in D.C. There's a real problem with teenagers, often as young as 12 and 13, but typically 15 and 16-year-olds, carjacking. And that incident was prominently reported upon last week when a former staffer in the administration was pretty viciously attacked when he thwarted an effort of, you know, a young group of teenagers, a gang, to take over and carjack his vehicle.
I'm not picking a fight with you, but do you think that would have led to this?
No.
If it were not a federal official?
No. I think actually there have been a number of federal officials. Congresswoman Angie Craig of Minnesota, a Democrat who happens to be running for the U.S. Senate in that state this year, she was attacked in an elevator in her apartment building in D.C. There have been other congressional staffers, one an intern for Senator Roger Marshall, who about 3 weeks ago was killed as an errant bullet hit him, and he was killed, a 21 or 20-year-old intern. So crime is a real problem in D.C., and I think that I just don't know what the federal government is going to be able to accomplish in 30 days. That's really going to be the question for me, because the crime rate in D.C. is alarming. The murder rate is alarming. It's not the highest in the country, though. There are, I think, three or four cities that have higher rates than Washington, D.C. Why this achieves such prominence is because that is the seat of the nation, and because there's a lot of interest and there's a lot of publicity on some of these very violent crimes that take place. And so it gets perhaps extraordinary attention. So the real question is going to be, how will the administration implement its strategy? Will it last over 30 days? And will it be effective?
Karen, I want to get to Karen Riedel, but we need to take a break. So I'm going to pause real quick. We'll take a break. We'll be back and we'll continue our discussion this morning. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. First news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday morning, the 12th of August, and it is a great privilege to be with our three panelists this morning, John Faso, Karen Riedel, and Mayor Kathy Sheehan. We are talking about the situation in the District of Columbia, Washington, D.C., and the president announcing yesterday of bringing in the National Guard and taking over control of the D.C. police because of rampant crime. Karen Riedel.
Thank you. So I'm a big fan of Washington, D.C., and my daughter is desperate to study in Washington, D.C. So I was surprised to hear yesterday and this morning from a lot of people who confirmed that living in D.C. can oftentimes feel unsafe. And so John, you also emphasized that a crime is a very serious issue in D.C., but there is no doubt in my mind that a federal approach is not the solution, to the crime issue. It's instead, it seems to be that crime in D.C. in particular, and I remember that from even 30 years ago, is very much localized, and it is committed by a relatively small number of people. So a very targeted approach is maybe a better approach rather than sending hundreds of National Guard members to the city. I think we share our preferred approach in that regard, a community-centered strategies that is are more effective in addressing the root causes of crime. Data is key. Reliable, credible data is key to understanding where crime comes from, the root causes of crime are. What crimes are we talking about? John, you mentioned a large number of murder cases in D.C., are these murder cases mostly related to domestic violence, for example? If that is the case, the approach has to be very different. So I am hoping that after the initial 30 days, and I have no doubt that this particular attention to D.C. is not only related to the fact that it is the backyard of the White House, but because it is in the interest of this administration to divert attention away from other issues. And that is why we're hearing about the efforts. Clearly, these efforts came out of nowhere. There are ad hoc approaches without any clear strategies in mind, without any real plans in mind. And Joe, I share your main concern about the approach to the homeless, whose rights seem to be taken away. Just because someone is homeless doesn't mean that the president isn't their president as well. It doesn't mean that they don't have constitutional rights. And I'm deeply concerned about the notion that they would be moved far away without being told where that will be.
And I think that, to your point, it is so important to engage with the community. And we have a president who is otherizing those who he is describing as committing these acts of violence. But to your point,
bloodthirsty criminals.
Bloodthirsty, violent gangs of bloodthirsty criminals, just like the ones that he pardoned. Who attacked the Capitol, I might add. But in any event, that's how some people would describe the people who attacked the Capitol, I should say. And so I think that when you do look at, and that's what we do, right? We unpack the data. We actually, unfortunately, had a slight increase in homicides 2 years after the pandemic. We were an outlier. Everybody else was going down. But when you looked behind each of those homicides, actually, I think it was something like 80% of them were domestic related. They were situations, that were very specific and personal. And so had we implemented and gone heavy on some of the strategies that we've used when we have seen group violence and group involved violence, that would have been ineffective because that wasn't what the underlying cause was. And so we brought in the pastors, we brought in community organizations, we talked about how to get help if you're in a situation where it's escalating. We really worked within the community to talk about what we saw that was happening. And so, again, we're a much smaller scale, and I agree that any level of violence, and the Mayor Bowser has said this, we don't condone any level of violence.
Right.
One homicide is a homicide too many. But I think it's really important to stop and ask what's been working, because it has dropped. And so what strategies have they been using, and how could potentially federal resources augment those so that they can continue to see this drive down or potentially accelerate it?
To me, that idea of what's working is key, and figuring out that, and is there something that really works? And I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure I've ever told this story on the air, but a few years ago, my wife was traveling in Atlanta, Georgia for work. She was on MARTA, the transportation system that brought her from the airport to her conference hotel in broad daylight. And two people got on the train, between one of the stops, they attacked her. They took a piece of steel. They bashed her in the face several times, broke many, if not most, of the bones in her cheek and nose and jaw, and caused a traumatic brain injury. Now, I'm happy to report she is fine. She is doing very well. She went through a long period of surgery and so forth. The question is, okay, now that person who did this, which apparently was an act of gang violence, ran off the train, never found, and what do you do? Those numbers are consistent. Those numbers have not changed. Those numbers don't go anywhere. And what do you do about that? How do you keep that from happening to someone? Because I know we talk a lot about these cases that are, yes, they're within families, within friends, within groups, within rivalries. But what do you do for average citizens who are visiting, especially a place like Washington, D.C.?
Look, I think that when we talk about this, we have to contextualize it. I think about three people who lost their lives in Austin because they went to Target.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
You know, I think this idea that we can be safe anywhere is one that is really elusive. And we can have a whole debate. You know, that act did not involve guns, but in many, many instances, we're talking about guns that are brought into communities. We haven't solved the problem of the iron pipeline. We haven't talked about it. And when we do talk about it, I don't see us making any progress. But I think that when you look at that experience, and I'm so sorry that that happened, it's horrifying. It's terrifying and it's frightening. You know, when we look at what has been working for us here to drive down crime, is treating every incident like that as if it were a homicide. So in the city of Albany, if a shot is fired, even if it doesn't hit a person, we investigate it as if it were a homicide, because it's so important to get somebody who's willing to engage in such a vile act of violence off the street. And right. So we have a very, very high homicide closure rate in the city of Albany, far higher than the national average because of that approach. So there are strategies around having a culture within a police department of saying, this could have been a homicide, and this is an individual who we're going to focus our attention on. That's some of the initiatives that we've undertaken with group violence, is that if a group is going to engage in violence, we treat the entire group, not just the person who committed the act of violence, but the entire group, as people who we need to send a message to that it's not okay. And we will use all of the resources available to us, including federal resources, to bring them to justice. And we've had very successful prosecutions where we have been able to charge people federally. And in the federal system, it's far easier for you to be convicted, and it's far more likely that you're going to go away for a much longer period of time. And so that holds real sway among people who might otherwise be thinking about engaging in this type of group violence.
But it's worth noting again that we are always looking for a fix after it already has happened. This approach by the federal government right now is looking for a quick fix, if that is in fact the objective. But it is worth reminding ourselves that long-term sustainable approaches to crime rates has to go to the root causes of crime, which is poverty, lack of opportunity, housing instability, trauma, certainly mental health in many ways, education, fair, good, solid, high-quality education for no matter where you live. All of these are factors we need to invest in order to achieve lower crime.
Karen, I agree with a lot of the factors you mentioned, but one you didn't mention, family breakdown. And I think that's the overwhelming cause of why you see juveniles 12, 13, 15 years old engaging in carjackings and gun violence, et cetera. Joe, that incident you referred to regarding your wife, that tragic incident, that might have been a gang initiation thing that
we believe it was.
Yeah, you've got to go out there and commit an indiscriminate act against some innocent person to prove your cred to become a member of the gang. I also look at New York, the bail reform and discovery reforms, so-called, that were enacted, part of the progressive agenda, have made it more difficult. They've also made it more difficult in the last few years, and you can't escape the pandemic and all of this as well. But recruitment for police departments is really a problem, not just in New York State, but across the country. And you see in district attorney offices, I've talked to many people who are DAs or assistant DAs who tell me that the discovery laws, which require them to produce these enormous volumes of of information, which is often not even relevant to the case, result in discouragement and an attitude among ADAs. What am I doing here? I came here to prosecute cases, and I'm a glorified bookkeeper. So a lot of the so-called reforms that have been made in New York State over the last few years have been counterproductive, in my view. And then you, Kathy, Mayor Sheehan mentioned the issue of the homeless, and I think that's right. I agree with a lot of what the mayor said, but I think there's a point where a lot of people are living on the street and they're severely mentally or drug or alcohol dependent, and their constitutional rights to lie there in their own feces on the street and then panhandle, et cetera. Is that humane? I mean, I think that we really need to reexamine some of the requirements that are in law where we could confine someone for their own benefit and good. But you have to have the resources in order to make that successful.
But those resources are gone on a federal level. Those resources you were talking about within the breakdown of the family, those resources are going for working with at-risk youth. And I don't know what you do as a counter to that.
And let me just say that the governor just signed significant amendments to the discovery rules that were endorsed by the New York State District Attorneys Association. And there were Democrat and Republican district attorneys at that announcement very supportive of that, because people shouldn't get off on a technicality, and we shouldn't be overly burdening the system with, you know, the types of things that were happening were abusive. And so kudos to the governor for recognizing that and fighting really hard, because there was resistance to it, to say, no, we've got to make some common sense reforms to that.
That's an admission that the initial things
too
broad.
I mean, I think that the initial things that were done that the defense bar took advantage of, and it needed to be fixed. I mean, that's very common in legislation. But in any event, I think the other piece of this with respect to looking at services, I agree with you, but there are no mental health beds. There is no support structure or a political appetite to create a support structure among Republicans for the very type of care that you're talking about. And so the only option is to throw someone in the county jail. And that, I think we all agree, is not going to result in a change in behavior. They're going to go to jail for 30 days or 60 days or however long a judge, if they do put them in jail for trespass, and then they're going to be right back out again. And so that is a conversation worth having. That is a conversation that I think we could build bipartisan support, but not when you have a president that is labeling these people as bloodthirsty animals.
Hmm. I just wonder, we're late for break, but I just to ask you, John, I mean, when you talk about, and I understand, you make a really good point about the homeless, of that being inhumane in and of itself, of being on the street and lying there and just, you know, in squalor. But if nothing is, if you're just going to, quote, round them up and bring them somewhere, and there is no meaningful program to put them in a better situation,
then it's not going to make it better.
Right.
I mean, you have to have a holistic, to use that word that I can't stand, approach to dealing with this problem.
I'm with you on that one, by the way.
You know, it's one of these things that I think we have to have this is an area where I think there can be bipartisan acknowledgement, because, you know, homelessness doesn't only happen to one race or creed or to one party or another. It happens, mental health and addiction happens broadly in our society. And so I think we have to address that, but we have to do it in a way that recognizes, yes, you have constitutional rights, but you don't have a constitutional right to destroy yourself lying on the street.
And that's why the governor's reforms that she got through on the mental health law, which does allow for people, yes, you're a danger to yourself or others, or if you are deemed by a doctor to not be able to make that decision, that you can be held. The problem is, held in a mental health bed, and there aren't enough mental health beds. So I think that's really, you know, that this change in the mental health law, it's new. We'll see whether it has impact. But just me anecdotally seeing what I see in our shift reports and happening, you know, in real time on the streets of Albany is that people are being taken to the hospital under the mental health law, and they're out within 24 hours.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to The Roundtable. John Faso, Karen Riedel, and Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan with us. And we got a good one going, so let's continue. We've got a lot of letters from our listeners on this subject. Coming out of the president saying that the feds are going to take control of Washington, D.C., and the police, and the calling in of the National Guard because of rampant crime. Jay said, so are you talking about criminalizing homelessness? When you mentioned detaining someone for their own good, is that not the same as criminalizing homelessness? You putting them into a situation where they can get better and providing health care and help for them? Or are you just detaining them so they can get sober, get up, and you release them? Re-release them.
I don't know that any of us were suggesting that. But I do agree, right? There's a balance, you know, between what is needed to have a safe and healthy community. So, for example, we do not allow encampments in the city of Albany. Low-income children growing up in formerly redlined neighborhoods should not lose the use of their parks because activists think that homeless people should be able to encamp there. And so it's the balance, right? And when you think about the impacts of this, it is impacting some of the most challenged neighborhoods and communities in the city of Albany. And so we have brought what we think is a very balanced approach, and that is that we've partnered with Albany County, and kudos to the county executive for reaching out and working with us on this. We now have case managers who are in the field 24/7. They're really available 24/7. We have psychiatrists who can actually prescribe. So if somebody has gone off their medication and they want their medication, but they haven't been able to access it, connecting them to medication. So we are taking an approach that is saying, yes, it's not humane, I don't think, to allow someone to die on the streets because they are in the throes of a mental health crisis. And that I don't think that that is humane. I think we have to get people the help that they need. And the governor's amendments to the mental health law recognize the fact that there are sometimes people who are not in a mental state to be able to make healthcare decisions for themselves. We do this all the time with people who have dementia. You know, there are guardrails on this. A judge has to weigh in and say, yes, you can proceed and provide this person with treatment. But we have to balance the quality of life and the expectations of people living in any community and their ability to access city services, parks, walk to school. Right. I mean, these are things that I think people don't often think about in an urban environment. We have children walking to school past the city mission. And there are people who were not admitted there for various reasons who are sitting at bus stops. Sometimes they are engaging in really disturbing activity and the police get there. We do what we can. But we've got to address that environment. And it's not about criminalizing homelessness, but it's about recognizing that this is a community. And particularly people who live in formerly redlined neighborhoods have been disproportionately negatively impacted by the social ills and challenges that we see and that we want to, as humane people, be able to address. We want to help people.
Well, that's one reason why you know, you mentioned this is a city mission. The city mission in Albany is a great place. Perry Jones does a wonderful job. one of the issues, and I've talked to some folks that work as volunteers there, one of the issues is they people will come in, and if they don't follow the rules, they can't stay.
Right.
And, you know, because often you're dealing with a population that for one reason or another, either they're mentally incapable or they're so addicted, they're not capable of following the rules. But this is another thing. And Mayor Sheehan mentioned, you know, children having to walk past disturbing scenes. This is one reason why the broken windows argument about policing and about communities makes a lot of sense, in my view. And a lot of progressives today resist that and reject it. But when Mayor Giuliani came in and Mike Bloomberg continued, they drove down the crime rate, the murder rate, the assault rate. It took us a lot to get Shelley Silver finally to let us use DNA evidence that we that police collect. And for years, that was an obstacle because the state assembly at that point under Shelley Silver wouldn't allow us to do it. We finally got it under Governor Pataki. But when residents walk past a building where there's, you know, maybe public urination or there are broken windows or there's signs of disorder, that makes people feel unsafe. And it's really important that people feel that their community is safe for themselves and their children. And I think that what you're seeing in New York City, we're likely to have a socialist mayor. And his ideas are, frankly, I think, going to be very disturbing to most people in New York City and elsewhere, because he wants to basically, he's called to defund the police. He's called to do a whole lot of things. Maybe he's trying to moderate himself a little bit now, but I very much doubt you'll see that. And, you know, that city of 8 million people that is the economic engine of this entire state, we all have a stake in making sure that New York City does not descend back into the chaos that existed in the 70s and 80s in New York City.
I thank you for that, John, because I was hoping we'd get 100 letters in a minute, and you just guaranteed that by talking about our
broken
socialist
windows.
No, the socialist mayor, I think. We'll see what happens. I could be wrong, but knowing many of our WAMC listeners, we'll see what happens. I want to get to a point. We don't have time to get into it before the break, but I would just like to tease it. And that is, and Karen, you may have even been the person, you were here yesterday, of bringing this up. But we're where we're at now. What's going to happen as a result of the Budget Reconciliation Act that was passed, which cuts homeless assistance programs and increases their criminalization of homelessness, not to mention the reduction of Medicaid, the reduction of SNAP funding, and also this focus on
you mean the reduction in the rate of increase of the spending on Medicaid?
Well, of reducing Medicaid and SNAP funding.
Reducing the rate of increase in Medicaid and SNAP funding. That's what's going to happen. It's not after 10 years. The CBO will tell you Medicaid will spend more than it does today. But the rate of increase is reduced. And this is a bandied about in the media indiscriminately without even considering some of the changes that are being made in how Medicaid is administered, how SNAP is administered, et cetera. That's another topic, but when you say cuts, I immediately want to point out that these are reductions in the proposed increases in spending.
And there are human beings behind each one of those reductions because, as we know, costs increase, the cost of medical care increases, and the we will see what happens in real time, and we'll be able to talk about it because, you know, cities are really the first place that this comes to roost. But, you know, I think the combination of the reduction in people available to work in healthcare, as well as the challenges that we're going to see with people who are cut and can't navigate their way back onto Medicaid, cut from SNAP benefits and can't navigate their way back on, we're going to see real impacts.
I have no doubt you're right, and in the language you're using, and there's the obviously some semantics here, but will fewer people have access to the services that had access to it before this was passed?
I would say that if you look at what happened during the pandemic, when the states the federal government waived any eligibility determinations,
right,
redeterminations for Medicaid, there are probably at the end of the pandemic anywhere from 15 to 20 million people who were still on Medicaid who were no longer income eligible for Medicaid. And so what much of what is happening is that in the last year, and this started under the Biden administration, Congress finally required the administration to reinstitute Medicaid redeterminations. Much of the many of the people who will, quote unquote, lose their coverage are people who will no longer be eligible because they don't meet the work requirements or the income requirements. But I think that if you look at here in New York State, where we spend more by every measure than any other state on Medicaid, it's simply the program has grown at a level that can't be afforded. And I think that there are other ways to address this issue. A lot of the folks that were in, say, the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, a lot of those folks can get employer-provided health insurance, but they were not getting it because Medicaid expansion provided it for them. So there will be some people, yes, I agree, there'll be some people that'll lose coverage, and we have to figure out a way to deal with that. But you have to have a program that's within certain eligibility rules. And, you know, the states, frankly, there was a Wall Street Journal documented this a few months ago. There were, if you moved from New York to New Jersey, for instance, and you applied for New Jersey Medicaid and you received it, the states were still paying the Medicaid managed care organization capitated monthly payments for people in New York, even though they had already gone to New Jersey. And there are billions of dollars estimated by CBO to be about $30 billion of unnecessary expenditure for people who were being paid twice by managed care organizations from the states, because the states didn't know that person had moved to another state. So one of the reforms that's in the reconciliation bill says that we will now, states will now be given the opportunity to check whether or not someone with that Social Security number was registered for Medicaid in another state. Some of those things are necessary reforms. Even Bernie Sanders agrees no one should be getting a Medicaid payment for the same person in two different states.
We are very late for a break. I blame David Giustina because if Ray were doing it, he would have glowered at me by now. David is not a glowerer. Well, he is, but not to be, at least in this situation. We'll take a break. We'll get news. We will return. We'll continue our conversation after this. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. John Faso is here, former New York 19th congressman and former New York assemblyman, professor of government at Dutchess Community College and president of the World Affairs Council of Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Riedel, and the mayor of the city of Albany, Kathy Sheehan, joins us, and we welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org. O-R-G. We have a lot of letters, so I'm going to go through them. I'll try to I'll read them, and if anybody wants to comment or to stop and investigate a bit more, we certainly can do that. Barbara said, most low-income workers offered health care coverage through their employers cannot afford that. Wanda, what John Faso said about getting Medicaid in two states has been happening and being monitored. Since I worked at the Medicaid Inspector General's office and I retired in 2014, this is not new in Trump's bill. What happens is that it takes several months for the records to catch up and the Medicaid managed care companies reimburse the funds to the state, no questions asked. The way John Faso describes it makes it sound like fraud. The other thing is that no one tells Medicaid recipients that they need to tell New York that they've moved. They think it's like their driver's license, that it's automatic.
Yeah, it's not fraud. I didn't want to infer that it was fraud. I'm saying that it's inefficiency in the way the program is administered. And that's now the states will have, under the National Accuracy Clearinghouse, it's called, they will have the ability to check on someone's enrollment in another state in real time, not months later.
Joe said you'd get 100 letters. Well, here's one. John Faso just completely misrepresented Soran Mandami's position on the police. The biggest and richest city in the country cannot survive if it's impossible for average working people to live there. The billionaires will do just fine. The scare tactics and lies about Mandami are a disgrace. Would you like to have Cuomo as mayor? Just to be clear, ordinarily, I really appreciate the perspective that John brings to the show, even if I don't always agree.
I'm reminded, John, though, of what Margaret Thatcher famously said about socialism, which is the only trouble with socialism, eventually you run out of other people's money. And what the Zoran Mandani is proposing is simply going to be unaffordable. It's going to present Governor Hochul with some interesting choices when the city council sends up home rule messages asking to increase individual and corporate income taxes in New York City. That will present the legislature and the governor with some interesting choices.
You know, I just want to say, though, when you look at income tax rates, and I'm not talking about New York State, I'm talking about nationally, the federal income tax rates, I don't think that people were referring to the United States as a socialist country back in the 1950s and 60s when those rates were very high for the highest income earners. We have the resources, and we just gave a huge tax break to the richest people in this country. And so that's the conversation that we need to have. And if you're going to call it socialism, then let's go in the Wayback Machine, because I think that we are not talking about socialism. We are talking about fairness. We are talking about when our country was growing the middle class at its fastest rates, and people were able to achieve the ability to purchase homes, to educate their families. I think when we look at what we were able to accomplish, people weren't calling that socialism, and we're not running out of money. And I think, a myth that people want us to think that, oh my God, if we take it from Elon Musk, somehow something horrible is going to happen to all of us. Well, and it's just not right.
Kathy, when you refer to the 50s and 60s or the 50s when the top rate was 90%, actually no one paid 90% because they had so many deductions and loopholes to take advantage of. And so, but no one was paying 90% back then. And I calculated recently, if you counted up the 100 richest people in the United States of America today, and Zoran Mandami says there should be no billionaires. Well, if you counted up the 100 richest people, their total assets would be about $4.5 trillion. That would pay about 60% of the federal government's budget in 1 year. And then once you've confiscated their wealth, they wouldn't have anything. So, you know, this whole business about the rich should pay their—
Taxes are not confiscating people's wealth. We're not talking about confiscating their wealth.
I was making an analogy to the notion that the so-called the rich should pay their quote-unquote fair share. The top 5% of the people in the country pay about 40% of the taxes. The top 10% of the people pay over 70% of the taxes. And so there's only a limit. You know, Elizabeth Warren had proposed a wealth tax, which brings up the analogy that I mentioned before. But there's a limit to how much you can expect to get by just simply going to the same well over and over again, as Mandami wants to do, taxing the so-called rich. First of all, they're mobile. They'll leave New York State. A lot of them have left New York State. But the real money is in the broad span of the country. And there's no way you close the deficits by just taxing one cohort of the population.
I want to pick up on this concept of socialism because it is misused here. And I blame Bernie Sanders actually for that, because Bernie Sanders is not a socialist, he's a social democrat. And I've grown up in a social democratic country, and I've just come back from a social democratic country. And I find this discussion, and I take one example of Mamdani's policy proposals, and that is making bus rides free. Now, they're free anyway because nobody pays for them, because you don't even know where to pay for the buses to begin with. But that is when you go to Germany, for example, where I was just there, when you use public transportation, you're supposed to pay for public transportation. Nobody checks. There is no turnstile. You just walk in, you ride the bus or the train or the subway. Nobody comes by to check. And it works because in a social democratic society, people understand that they have to contribute to the system in order for the system to work. If you don't do your share, you won't be able to make the system sustainable. So there's a lot of misunderstanding of what social democracies really are. It's not about paying for everything, and therefore it's not about running out of money. I think Thatcher was incorrect about the understanding of what social democracies are. But I'm also concerned about the term of socialism, which ends any conversation about policies that should be debated. There's quite a bit of value in the ideas behind them.
Marion writes, democratic socialism does not mean chaos. Think Denmark. Stop speaking out of prejudice and ignorance. Electing the candidate that doesn't have any criminal history and has a track record for intelligence and success might eliminate chaos, not create it. Then we go to Michael. Mayor Kathy, can you mention which communities in Albany are redline communities and when did they get that designation?
So redlining is a tactic that was actually used by the federal government when they started to guarantee mortgages. And they actually had maps where they showed undesirable neighborhoods where they would not guarantee those mortgages. And thus the term redline. They were actually literally in red. So if you look at the map of Albany, the formerly redline neighborhoods, this is a map that dates back to the 30s and 40s and 50s. Where mortgages wouldn't be written. And even after those laws were changed so that you couldn't discriminate, it didn't really matter because banks continued to discriminate and not write mortgages in those neighborhoods. You would find Arbor Hill, West Hill, and the south end of Albany in those neighborhoods. And so that is the impacts of that we continue to feel today because of the lack of investment, the inability to actually borrow money to invest in a home in those neighborhoods led to the continued decline in those neighborhoods. If you couldn't borrow money to fix up your home, you moved. Landlords came in. That's where we lost a lot of homeowners in those neighborhoods because you literally couldn't buy a home. And by the way, yes, these maps were drawn and undesirable neighborhoods were neighborhoods that were predominantly people of color. And so, Albany is part of a national story. There's a long and disgraceful history of redlining. It happened all across the United States. And if you Google redline maps for various cities, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about.
We'll go to Greg. Please, I'm begging you, stop. With any talk of actual crime and local governance issues as a pretext to what Trump is doing in Washington, D.C., this is an autocratic fascist military takeover of the capital of the United States, with the likely outcome of preventing the peaceful transfer of power come 2028. Then we go to a letter titled Martial Law in D.C. Stephen, Epstein, this is why Trump declared D.C. a war zone. It's a diversion from talking about Epstein. Then, Peter, the person-on-person crime rate in Texas is higher than the same crime rates in D.C., yet I see no apparent readiness to send the guard into Greg Abbott's Texas. This move by Trump is purely political and partisan. I have heard no criticism of this move on the part of his cult following, the now-defunct Republican Party. Trump is becoming more and more unhinged, and his people just sit by and applaud. David, it's weird how Faso, that's you, John, only likes to compare crime rates in blue cities. There's lots of red cities with higher murder rates than New York and D.C. combined, but they are in red states, so they get a pass from Trump. This is getting people ready for a military takeover of the country. There's a lot in the mail about that military takeover.
Yeah, I think it's way overstated, and the term fascist is one that's used, real fascists. Trump does a lot of things, but it's pretty hard for me to bring him to that level. I would just say that the real proof in the pudding on the D.C. thing is what are they going to do in these 30 days? What true real manifestations of change and policy will they implement that will have an effect upon reducing the perceived problems with the crime rate? And I think it's going to be very difficult for them to accomplish that in 30 days. I think they're probably going to go and ask Congress to give them more authority over the next year, perhaps. But again, This is going to be really difficult for them to change some of these issues in a single city. And I hope they can, but I think it's going to be difficult. And the president is going to have the responsibility for it now that he's taken this action.
Sorry, just a quick follow-up question. Who would be the they asking for an extension? Is it they? Well, who would be the ones asking for it?
The administration would have to ask Congress to give them authority because his authority is only for 30 days under the law.
I think the real question is what happens if there is a large, huge, peaceful protest or march in D.C. in the next 30 days and you've got the head of the U.S. Marshals who was told, if you're soft, weak, and pathetic like so many people, I will fire you so fast. You have a president who has shown a lack of tolerance for even peaceful protests, much less civil disobedience. I can't imagine what he would have done when there were the, you know, sit-ins at the drug counters, at the drugstores in the South, given his rhetoric. So, look, I think that that is something that, you know, there are those who are very concerned that this is part of a broader attempt by the president to send a very, very strong message. And if there is a large protest, a large gathering in the Capitol, if they you know, obstruct a street, I'm not sure what we can expect. These 120 FBI agents, 50 deputy U.S. marshals, DEA agents, and the National Guard to do and how they will be directed to respond.
If you mix skepticism with cynicism, you get a question like this one, which I'm about to ask. But if you right now are using numbers and saying that the crime rate is the highest it's ever been in Washington, D.C., and you're using those numbers to say we're going to go into the cities, we're going to take over the city, and we're going to take care of that problem. And then a month later, you start using the numbers that are the numbers that we see now, then can't you claim great victory as if there was some massive change that has taken place?
Let's mark the calendar for a month from now, Joe, and we'll see.
Okay.
But it was already heading down. And so that is exactly the right question, because had he, you know, this is moving in the direction that it needed to be moving in because of whatever it is that they're doing in D.C. that's working. You know, you look at what's happening in Baltimore and you've seen a significant murder rate is still far too high. But, you know, you look in Baltimore and you say, you know, in 1 year in a city and I'm not sure what the whole population is, but they made like hundreds of thousands of arrests and they still had 300 homicides. The number of arrests that they've made has declined precipitously, and the murder rate and the number of homicides has fallen every year. And so this idea that we're going to go in and we're going to be tough and we're going to do whatever it is he's setting you up to do, because he's calling them violent gangs and bloodthirsty criminals, right? So that's your mindset of who you're dealing with, roving mobs. That somehow if we just arrest more people, we're going to reduce crime. And if you look at data over time, there's not a correlation there. You have to do more than just arrest people.
There is, though, I think it's true, and I've seen some data in the past that a high percentage of the crimes are committed by a very small number of the people. And if their focus is trying to go after the small groups and gangs that are committing a fair number of these crimes, then you might see some appreciable declines in criminal activity. So we see this in other places around the country as well. I mean, a lot of the crime is committed by a very small number of people.
And you are more successful in being able to address those issues when you've built trust in the community and when you have people who are actually willing to call the police and to say, we don't want this in our neighborhood. We don't want this on our block. This is what's happening. And we're going to help and cooperate with the police. That takes a tremendous amount of work. We weren't there even 20 years ago in the city of Albany. And I'm not going to say that we've waved a magic wand and that it's all perfect now, but we have built far more trust within the community because we're not engaging in these tactics of we're going to throw everyone up against a wall and we're going to occupy your neighborhood. we're going to respect you and we're going to recognize that you deserve to live on a safe street, even if you're low income. And if we can both agree to that and work together to keep this community safe, then we need to cooperate. And when people do choose to engage in violent behavior, we've got to work together to keep your street safe. And the way that we do that is by cooperating and working together. And so, you know, and it's different in every community. And the approach to policing, though, is really important. You have to have the community involved.
We have to take a break. We'll continue on the other side of that break and move on to another subject or two. We'll be right back after this news update from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday, the 12th of August. 34 minutes past 12 o'clock, and we have John Faso, Karen Riedel, and Kathy Sheehan.
Past 10 o'clock.
What did I say, 9 o'clock?
12.
12 o'clock? That's just wishful thinking. That is just wishful thinking.
I've always said you were ahead of your time.
Oh,
Joe.
Yeah. Well, thank you, John. That's very nice. So the U.S. inflation report shows effects of President Trump's tariffs. Why go through a day without talking about tariffs? A gauge of underlying inflation in July showed prices increasing at the fastest annual pace in 5 months, a sign that businesses are passing along tariff-related costs to customers. A key measure of underlying inflation rose in July as President Trump's tariffs intensified price pressures across a wider range of consumer goods and services, although the overall increase was likely not significant enough to deter the Federal Reserve from lowering interest rates at its next meeting in September. The consumer price index stayed steady at 2.7% compared to the same time last year. On a monthly basis, prices rose 0.2% from June, but an important gauge tracking consumer prices that strips out volatile food and energy prices accelerated more rapidly. Core CPI, which is closely watched by the central bank, jumped 0.3% over the course of the month, or 3.1% on a year-over-year basis. That is one of the largest monthly increases so far this year and represents the fastest annual pace in 5 months in June. Core inflation rose 0.2% from the previous month, or 2.9% from July 2024. A lot of numbers. What do they mean?
Well, there are a lot of numbers, and I think the jury is out on whether the tariff policy, as it's now, you know, coming forward, what impact that's going to have, how much of the cost increases for imported goods are exporters going to swallow, how much are the importers going to swallow, and how much will get passed on to consumers. It's probably a portion of all three. So I think the administration has announced a couple of tentative trade deals, which are pretty good for us. How much the tariff policy is actually going to change consumer buying patterns is I think still up in the air, but you notice the stock market is doing very well since the so-called Independence Day announcements back in April. The market is doing well. There are the trade agreements, the payments that you're going to see coming from the European Union and from Japan and others are quite interesting. A lot of concerns about whether or not we're having too much government control in terms of investment decisions in the economy. I'm starting to hear that a bit. But so far, I think the reaction in the marketplace has been rather muted to all the economic uncertainty that is brought about by the president's tariff policy. The last thing I would say is that the passage of the tax bill, the extension and made permanent of things like immediate expensing for companies when they make investments, that creation of certainty in the economy for investors and for corporations looking to invest capital is really important. And I think that that's going to be the overwhelming influence upon economic activity. So I think that certainty that they achieve by passing the tax bill and making it most of those provisions permanent is going to be very beneficial in the short and long term for the economy.
Well, I think it's going to be very beneficial for the wealthiest Americans. I think it's going to accelerate the inequity that we continue to see in our economy. We're incredible inequity with respect to where the wealth has gone over this last decade and a half. And it's gone to the wealthiest, and the middle class is really, really struggling. And I think the other piece of this is that, you know, you have these large corporations who might have the ability to absorb some of these tariffs, but, you know, roughly, you know, half of our population is employed by small businesses. They're a tremendous contributor to the economy, and they are much less able to absorb the impacts of these tariffs. You know, even our local restaurants are impacted by these tariffs. And so that, I think, is what remains to be seen. I think because of the on-again, off-again nature of it, we haven't seen what the final full impact is going to be. We may never. I mean, this president may just do this for the next 4 years. I don't know.
The courts may actually rein his tariff policies in, too.
But I do think that, again, you know, when you look at the percentage of our population employed by small businesses and note that many of those individuals are, you know, middle class working families who continue to earn less and see their piece of the pie shrink, it's not surprising that the stock market's doing well. But those folks aren't benefiting from that.
Karen.
Just to piggyback on what you just said, it seems that where we see the real increases in prices is precisely where the middle class, the low middle class, is affected. Takeouts and restaurants have jumped by 3.9%, and even higher prices for used cars, housing, and medical care. And that, of course, these are areas that hurt the middle class and low middle class the most.
Although consumer spending, I just saw some reports this morning, consumer spending really jumped in the last month. So that's a good sign because the American economy is heavily influenced by the actions of consumers. So that maybe some of that spending was get the products purchased before the tariffs come into place, some of that. So I think a lot of this is still uncertain and up in the air.
I mean, it seems that way, and you get varying numbers from time to time. But it also seems to me, and I only know what I hear from my panelists. But
boy, you're a pretty ignorant guy. Huh?
but there are a lot of different numbers. A lot of them are contradictory, and it's going to take a while. It's going to take time to be able to look at it and say, this is what has happened, this is what is happening, this is what is going to happen.
I think it's going to be really a full year before we have a better picture of the true impact of all of these variety of policy changes. And then, of course, you still have the Fed. I think that most people are expecting the Fed to cut interest rates twice through the rest of the year. That probably will happen in September and October. They're anticipating interest rates coming down by Fed activity twice before the end of the year.
All right. Anybody else on that? Okay. Let's move on to another topic for this Tuesday morning as we have to take a break in just a second, but we'll try to get one more story in before that. And I'd like to talk about the idea of, since we're talking about trade, let's talk about China and the fact that tariffs on China were set to rise sharply on Tuesday, and now the trade truce has been extended by 3 months. President Trump's order continues a reprieve from the threat of escalating tariffs and export controls, which rocked the global economy earlier this year. President Trump signed the executive order on Monday, extending a trade truce between the U.S. and China for another 3 months, continuing a reprieve from the threat of escalating tariffs and export controls, which rocked the global economy. The extension until November 10th gives the countries more time to work out their differences and set the stage for a potential summit between the leader of China and Mr. Trump later this year. Mr. Trump suggested on Monday that there had been progress in the negotiations. Karen?
I'm not surprised about the truce. China is a trade war with China is one that we simply cannot win. And that was clear from the beginning. China pushed back right away after the initial announcements of what was it, 125% tariffs. They immediately pushed back, and they can. And so I'm not surprised about the truce. So let's see where this goes.
Kathy?
Apparently, people will be able to buy as many dolls as they want for Christmas. And I think that that is what this is about. It's about making sure that we don't have a huge de-escalation in the ability of consumers to be able to have access to goods and for importers to be able to stock their shelves ahead of the holidays. I don't know. I think your comment was more cynical than mine, but that's a pretty cynical, I guess.
Well, and just in case anyone had missed it, there was the administration had been saying, well, why do you need to buy three or four dolls when you can just do with one around the holidays? And so quit whining about it. Yes?
Yeah, I think obviously a trade war with China is has a lot of consequences. It's very interesting. You saw Apple and Nvidia coming to deals with President Trump about investments in the United States, about whether Nvidia chips or certain chips will now not be subject to tariffs. There's a lot of moving parts that are in play. China remains our main military and economic competitor. It's really going to be important, I think, for hopefully we can have some type of permanent peace between Russia and Ukraine, because the unity of purpose between Xi Jinping and Putin, I think, is extremely worrisome for our national security. And I'm just hopeful that that Ukraine is not sold down the river in any additional negotiations. I do think that it's in the American national interest and the world's interest for Ukraine to retain its sovereignty and its independence. And the closer it gets to the West and the European Union, the better, in my view. And I'm disheartened that I see there's an unwillingness on the part of the administration to continue to support Ukraine and their fight against Russia with military assets. I think they're correct in terms of insisting that the Europeans finally step up. But I don't think that this can really happen without American leadership as well. So I wish that the administration had a different position on military support for Ukraine, because I think that ultimately would be the pressure point. And I think we should be confiscating the frozen Russian assets and providing those to Ukraine to help pay for their economy and their reconstruction. I think there's very little that's going to dissuade Vladimir Putin from his lifelong aim to restore the Soviet empire.
So I just have one more question. I know you have to go, but the question about NVIDIA. Where does that stop as far as companies who are going to be embraced by the administration to say, okay, if you want to play ball, we're going to have a cut of that?
It's this is brave new world for the United States, and the degree to which the administration is pressing this point with private sector companies is really unprecedented. And you also saw this week the the back and forth between the president and the head of Intel.
Right.
And they met this week as well. So a lot of this is wrapped up into our overall issues with China. And I don't think we can escape that. And that's the reality, because these companies want to do business. The whole AI revolution is taking place, and we can't allow China to achieve dominance in that regard. But the American tech companies want to be able to continue to do business with China, because they view that as a way to assert American dominance. But time will tell whether or not that strategy plays out.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll finish up the show. John Fassler, thank you very much for being with us. I know you have to run for a meeting, but thank you very much for being with us as always. It's always an honor to have you on the program. We'll be back with Mayor Kathy Sheehan and Karen Riedel right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Just a few minutes to wrap up this edition of the Tuesday panel. We still have Karen Riedel and Mayor Kathy Sheehan with us. I do want to did anybody want to – we were talking about NVIDIA and the 15%. Does anybody have any –
I mean, and you asked the question, like, where is this money going to go?
Right.
And either – so either it's against – it's anti-competitive, or it's against U.S. interests, it's, you know, bad policy to sell these chips to China, or it's not. And this 15% sort of payment isn't going to make up for that, right? And I think that's what the American people want to know. Like, what is this? And why is it okay now? Why should we feel okay about it because you're getting 15%? What danger existed that resulted in you saying you couldn't sell these chips that has now been alleviated by a 15% payment? It doesn't make a lot of sense. And I think it's right for the American people to ask and want to know.
Ask those questions. All right. Let's go to one more topic, and then we'll call it a day here on the roundtable. I wanted to ask about let's go with Harvard, because this is a story that obviously has been in the news for a long time. And the question is, while other educational institutions have taken a settlement with the Trump administration, Harvard seemed to be the one who was going to hold out. Now, a potential $500 million settlement is being talked about, and the both Harvard and the White House say they're moving toward that settlement, which would end a months-long battle that pitted the nation's wealthiest school against the Trump administration's extraordinary crackdown on higher education. Harvard University and the Trump administration are nearing a landmark legal settlement that would see Harvard agree to spend $500 million in exchange for the restoration of billions of dollars in federal research funding, according to four people familiar with the deliberations. Negotiators for the White House and the university have made significant progress in their closed-door discussions over the past week, developing a framework for a settlement to end their months-long battle. The talks could still collapse as President Trump and senior Harvard officials need to sign off on the terms of the deal. The sides are still going back and forth over important wording for a potential agreement. But under the framework coming together, Harvard would agree to spend $500 million on vocational and educational programs and research. Three of the people said that figure currently penciled in to be paid out over years would meet a demand from President Trump that Harvard spend more than double what Columbia University agreed to pay last month. It would also satisfy Harvard's wish that it not pay the government directly, as Columbia is doing.
You know, I will never understand why our government decided to withhold funds that benefit It's people, it's economy, the world. I will never understand it. And I applaud Harvard for pushing back right from the beginning. I think now if this deal moves forward, I think Harvard is getting away with it in a good way. It would allow the Trump administration to save face, but Harvard in return would keep its academic independence and safeguard a key revenue stream without sacrificing its control over the curriculum. And Columbia did not. Columbia gave up a lot of key aspects of questions related to the curriculum. Now, I find it really interesting that Harvard agreed to fund vocational training. Now, is that going to be Harvard providing the vocational training? Where does that money go?
Another question of where does the money go?
Well, I think that for me, I share sort of the head scratching around why is our federal government even in this space, right? I mean, historically, people have not had an inability to hold private universities accountable when they believe that their civil rights have been violated or that they are acting in a way that violates the Constitution. And so, you know, all of the case law around affirmative action and around admissions policies has been built up around private lawsuits, people suing and saying, I didn't get into this university because of X, right? And more recently, I didn't get into this university because I'm white and I was passed over for a less qualified, candidate of color. And so that's how this case law has evolved. To see the federal government under this president who has catered to white supremacists, who, certainly is supported by and has given voice and power to people who have a very different view of what the future of this country should be with respect to who's in charge and who's quote unquote qualified, to now be in this space. And then you add to that the demands for admissions data, including race, for these private institutions. You know, this is about an agenda that I think is something that many of us thought were part of the past in this country, and is now rearing its ugly head again. And, this whole conversation around what's happening at these institutions, I think, is because there is a belief among this group that are very strong supporters of Trump that somehow these institutions are educating the wrong people, are too liberal in their thought, and too dismissive of and their ideas and their values. And I think there's a very big difference between supporting conservative, points of view and allowing them to have voice. I think there should be academic freedom to do that, and some of the blatant and clear racism that exists among a core group of Trump supporters.
We'll end it there for this morning. My thanks to all of our wonderful panelists, John Faso, Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan, and Dr. Karen Riedel. Thank you so much for being with us. Very good show this morning. We always welcome your letters, and we thank you for writing this morning. We'll be back right after this.